Okay, so this session is on theory and research. We have two speakers and one respondent. I'll just very briefly introduce Julia Kane and Dennis Greenwood, who are colleagues of Dell at the Research Centre for Therapeutic Education at Roehampton. And from one on my left is Dennis Bond, who's a member of the British Psychoanalytical Society. I think we should go straight ahead. Julia, you're going first with your paper on the in-between. And Dennis will then do his paper on labelling.
Okay, can you hear me? Is that okay? Right. I think I'd better just start by saying, in the words of a singer called Max Bygraves, I'm going to tell you a story. And that's all it is. This is a story. And the story I'm going to tell is about, in part, some research that I did and some ways of thinking that have emerged from that are perhaps in line with some of the things that have been talked about this morning in terms of post-existentialism. So this paper considers a question of how we research practice in terms of what happens between two people engaged in therapy, the patient and the therapist. And in order to consider this, I'm going to do sort of three things, really. Firstly, I'm going to say something quite brief about what is research. Secondly, I'm going to kind of look at the research that I did and raise some questions about post-existentialism and the implications of that for practice. And thirdly, I'm going to say something about reverie as a way of researching practice. Just as a kind of note, that one of the problems of starting to talk about something like reverie or anything as a way of doing something is that people will take it away and turn it into a methodology. But, you know, a bit like we do with theory, they'll take it away, it could become a new method for researching phenomenologically, much like IPA, which has got quite a lot of currency at the moment. And that's really not what I'm trying to do, but I also understand that inevitably, the minute we speak of something and write of it, that's the tendency, and it's very difficult to get away from that. So, having said that, I'm just going to start by saying a few things about research in general. So the first thing I'd like to say is that there are many ways of conducting research, and a particular problem is that many terms, such as evidence, that the empirical, and indeed the term research, have been appropriated by positivist approaches, where a hypothesis is posited and then researched by drawing on an accepted method or methodology. And the problem with this is that we lose sight of the other and the original and other possible meanings of terms like empirical. So, for example, empirical just means observation. That's all it means, observation or derived from experience. So derived from experience rather than through logic or scientific proof. And the problem is, of course, that term now actually means the opposite. So the term empirical now is distanced from notions of our experience. And it's just very interesting when you look up the word in an ordinary etymological dictionary, it's very concerned with experience. And yet, for some reason, our own experience in a situation is now not considered to be evidence or valid evidence. So the difference between a positivist view and what is here called post-phenomenological is less about a distinction between qualitative and quantitative methods and more to do with differing beliefs about the world. For example, hermeneutic approaches would view practice as research. And indeed, Gadamer, in his seminal work, Truth and Method, points out that formal techniques, i.e. research methods, will tend to find what they seek, i.e. You find what you already know. It's always concerned with the already known. Indeed, in the book chapter, I tried to show how research methods develop from and thus tend to support and legitimate the beliefs within which they're situated. So, for example, if you're coming from a rational empirical viewpoint, there would be a tendency to seek more logical and tangible approaches to research in order to legitimate your findings, or indeed to legitimate the position you already take up. So it becomes a sort of closed system. So what I'm going to try and do here is to show how a particular method that I used in a piece of research was both unhelpful and helpful in terms of what it revealed and concealed. And then to try and show how reverie can offer a different way of undertaking research. So I undertook a piece of research where I was interested in asking people how they sort of learned and thought about the unknown. And I was trying not to kind of posit that on an existing theory like the unconscious. I was just trying to kind of open up an idea about unknowing and uncertainty in practice. And I undertook interviews where I basically asked people that question. And then I utilised what's called an empirical, here's a wonderful contradiction in terms, an empirical phenomenological method. I utilised that to analyse interview transcripts. And then the way that you do that is that there are basically five or six steps that you go through. You read the interview transcripts. You then break each transcript down into what are called units of meaning. You try to identify, you know, what a person meant in a small passage of the interview transcript. And then you begin to kind of identify categories of things that belong together. So you're kind of following a series of steps to analyse your interview transcripts. So what you can see is that I was using a well-known method, a method that's already in existence, to carry out research. And although it's a qualitative method, I would say it's still positivistic because I posited a question that I then sought to explore. And so my argument would be that even qualitative approaches are still positivist. Okay, so having done that, I don't want to kind of go into too much detail today about the kind of findings that I had from that kind of analysis. What I really want to do is to try to say to you how that kind of data analysis, as it's called, is helpful and how it's unhelpful. And I have to say, in fact, I find it largely unhelpful. I didn't really realise that until I was in the midst of doing it. But I began to realise there were things this kind of analysis will never reveal to you. It will always hide things. I mean, you could argue that any method will hide some things and reveal others. So some of the things that were helpful about using, this was a guy called Georgie's phenomenological method. Some of the things that were helpful were that, you know, you have to read and line by line your interviews, and you really start to get immersed in them, and you become in some ways kind of very familiar with what was happening. I mean, some would say that familiarity is perhaps less helpful. It also provides a way to organise your kind of findings so that you can write them down and publish them. So it gives you a way of sort of being systematic. Again, some of these things are arguable. And the other thing that it did do is it helped me to kind of notice all the different meanings that people were ascribing to this idea of the unknown. Although I would say that they were the kind of manifest meanings, or rather the overt meanings. But perhaps what this method couldn't do was to actually help you to think about what Freud called latent meaning, would be one way of thinking about it. So the method was unhelpful in a number of ways. The first is that when you use a method like that, you focus so much on the method, you lose sight of the person that you were talking to, and you lose sight of the conversation that the two of you were having. You lose sight of what was going on between you. The problem as well with this method is it moves away from the individual, the contextual, and the uniqueness of individual experiences to attempting to kind of generalise in a kind of phenomenological way, which of course is kind of the antithesis of what phenomenology is about in some ways. It's also very difficult when you're following this kind of method to take account of things that don't fit, that you can't fit into a category. And I'm going to say a bit more about some of this in a minute. The other thing is that the method conceals anxiety. It conceals the researcher's anxiety, i.e. my anxiety. And I think it concealed for me the anxiety that was generated by the question that I was asking. I think asking people about the unknown was actually turned out to be a really quite anxiety-provoking question, but I didn't realise it at the time. And then there is one major assumption about all these kinds of methods, which I just happened to read as a throwaway line in Georgie's book. And in the book he says that the only way to analyse a text is to break it down into manageable pieces. And of course, I don't know, but that's not what we do in practice, is it? We don't examine line by line what a patient says. I think, you know, Freud, for example, spoke about this idea of evenly suspended attention or evenly hovering attention, which we might think of as the horizontalization that's spoken about in phenomenology, where you just listen and wait with patience and suffering and all of that. So what I kind of felt was that the very things that this method were unhelpful with were the very things that I was interested in, and that I thought as therapists researching practice, these are the very things we should be interested in. And I didn't really realise just how problematic all this was until I was analysing a particular transcript where that took me 3 days to transcribe 1 hour of transcript. And I was in such a kind of anxious state with it that I didn't realise what trying to transcribe this tape was doing to me until my husband came up the stairs and said, "Oh, is that the same voice that I've heard every day for 3 days? Whatever's going on?" And he kind of shook me out of my kind of stupor and got me thinking about what was going on. But I couldn't, the method that I was following was too limiting to let me kind of question that, because it wasn't in what the person was saying, it was in the saying of it. It was in the way it was being said. And when I went back and just sat and listened to the transcript, I could hear a huge amount of anxiety, and both my own and the person that I was interviewing. So I basically got on and did my analysis because, you know, the best way to be able to be critical of something is to get familiar with it, utilise it, and then look back and start to question it. Someone once said to me, you should always kind of know what your competitors are saying. So, I'm just a bit aware of time. So I think what I'm going to go on and do now is to talk a bit about reverie as a different way of thinking about research. And this could be whether you've done maybe interviews with people or whether you're just going to draw on your practice as a form of research in itself. I don't think it kind of matters which way you're doing it. But actually, what I'm not going to do is to say very much about Bion. I know Bion has written a lot about reverie, but one of the problems with it is that the word reverie has been around for centuries before Bion kind of took hold of it. And of course the other thing is that Bion was really positing his ideas about reverie on the unconscious. You know, that reverie is a way to the unconscious. And I kind of wanted to stay away from the idea that the unknown is the same as the unconscious. My argument would be the unconscious is just one story about unknowns. So the version of reverie that I'm just going to say a few things about here comes from a French philosopher called Gaston Bachelard. And he draws on reverie in the kind of old-fashioned meaning of reverie as an abstracted musing, daydreaming, wandering. So it's kind of to do with dreaming and imagination and the poetic. It's not a term that was invented for psychoanalysis, but rather borrowed by Bion and also developed by someone called Thomas Ogden as a way of exploring the relational in practice. So whilst reverie is well known in the psychoanalytic literature, the focus here is on Bacalar's work. In his work, reverie or daydreaming was argued as questioning traditional epistemology that sees thinking as preceding thought. This is just such an important idea for me. I just find this so difficult to explain. I was trying to explain this idea to my daughter last night. I was reading this, and we got into such a tangle. And in the end, she said, "Mum, I know what you mean." But actually, it's this idea that we can set out to think about something, and then if we do that, we'll be able to think about it. But there is an argument that if you set out to think, you'll just think what you already think. And what Bacalard was also interested in was the idea of disruption. What disrupts that kind of thought? And for me, the kind of thing that might disrupt thought are the sort of reveries that I might have that might not be very politically correct, might not quite fit in with what I'm supposed to be thinking, but which maybe I shouldn't ignore. And so this notion of disruption is a kind of, I guess it's very political, isn't it? It's very political to disrupt the sort of the major discourse of the time, which is what Bacalard was doing. The other thing that Bacalard's reverie does is it argues that this is not about, we're not trying to represent human experience. Actually, reverie is a creative act. We're always reinventing it. We're not reconstructing it. We're reinventing it. It's quite different. So what else can I say about out of time? So I thought there's a problem here. I can't tell you how to do reverie. Nobody can tell you. I could say a few things that it might be about the phenomenological idea that we need to revisit the obvious and attend to the strange. And by that I mean the obvious and strange in our own thoughts. That we might attend to our own imaginings and delay deciding what they mean and try and hold them open. But this requires a tolerance of a lot of uncertainty and unknown. But the danger in my saying that to you is that I'm now turning reverie into another technique. And actually, Bacalard never did that. In his writings, he doesn't tell you how to do reverie. His writings are the reverie. And I just wanted to read you a little bit of what he has to say about reverie. He says, through this reverberation, by going immediately beyond all psychology or psychoanalysis, we feel poetic power rising naively within us. After the original reverberation, we are able to experience resonances, sentimental repercussions, reminders of our past. But the image has touched the depths before it stirs the surface. I find that kind of rather moving. So I would just say, I'm trying to tell you a story about a story that can never be told. And that, I guess, is what we're all doing all the time. We can never really get to the story we're trying to tell. That's it.
Thinking about starting this with singers, I was thinking about Frank. So I also want to tell you a story about my journey in terms of research. I also want to say to apologise for anyone who knows anything about philosophy where I start, because I don't really, or didn't when I started. I'm going to talk about a lot of philosophy, but it's more to do with my journey through philosophy in order to explore a way of doing a piece of research which was quite important to me. The talk is so entitled a different way, and I had the title on the previous slide. This was the research question which was where I started in terms of researching a person working with a person diagnosed with dementia. And the many ways that one could, I suppose, conceive of addressing this research question, and there's lots of different approaches, but I'm just going to talk about the way that I approach this particular question. There are many ways that the question might be researched, but I made an assumption very early on in addressing this question. If I was able to provide an example of where psychotherapy had taken place with a person diagnosed with dementia, this would provide evidence, in inverted commas, to enable me to give an affirmative answer to this question. Opportunistically, I was provided with a chance of working with a person that had been diagnosed with dementia. At the outset of this study, I was undeterred by the fact that I was both researcher and therapist. After all, if it was good enough for Freud, it was surely good enough for me. But this simplistic assumption landed me in the middle of a real epistemological and methodological minefield that I will try to open up just a little today. Maybe I'm being a bit too optimistic with how far I'm going to go with this, but anyway, we'll see what happens. Freud conceived psychoanalysis as being a research method in itself, legitimately contributing to scientific understanding of mental life. And that accounts for his work with patients, and that the accounts of his work with patients recorded at the end of each day constituted evidence. Freud located psychoanalysis within a scientific discourse, but the instrument he conceived for modifying knowledge towards general theory was and is considered problematic in many scientific researchers due to its dependency on a subjective account by the researcher, observer or analyst. According to Kasdien, the case study approach advocated by Freud fails to meet the requirements of a research method designed to contribute to scientific knowledge. Yin, very much the leading figure in case study research, advocates a more scientifically vigorous approach to the use of case study research. Fornegie, mentioned earlier today, and Moran state that the Freudian approach to case study has largely been discredited in many fields of social science. They go on to say that there is a need to enhance the internal validity of the data gathered in the clinical setting. However, I discovered that this launch into a vigorous critique of Freud's claim to have discovered a practice-based research method needed a more fundamental examination in relation to some of the very basic epistemological assumptions. Scientific method could be seen as an attempt to prove that an observer's perception does indeed correspond to the reality of what has been experienced. Glitch. I'm fed up with that anyway, so we'll leave it behind. Croty states that the scientific method of verifying experience becomes a basis for positivism, where a view of the world is posited, thereby creating a foundation for building further knowledge, not based on speculation, but rather drawn from experience. The positing of knowledge within a scientific discourse is achieved by either deductive or inductive methods. The deductive method begins with a theory and then seeks to test it by possibly designing an experiment. The inductive approach facilitates the emergence of a theory or hypothesis directly from an observation. The intention behind both approaches is to formulate and then test a hypothesis that provides the basis of an explanation or general theory that can be applied to the world around us. But the whole process is dependent on human beings. It relies on their perception, honesty and integrity. It depends on the researcher's expertise and common sense. The more that you highlight the dependency on a person, the more potentially fallible the whole exercise becomes. It basically is dependent on the assumption that what a scientist perceives to be the results of their research actually corresponds to what took place in the external world before them. However, there's a whole barrage of philosophical arguments that challenge the appropriateness of this somewhat naive assumption, beginning with Descartes, as a mathematician who began to try to discover a foundation for reality, and then ended up believing that the only thing that he could really trust were his thoughts. The external world could potentially be illusory. The cognito, I think, therefore I am, provides a fundamental challenge to the naive realists that believe that external world directly related to human perception. However, Descartes' philosophical scepticism provided the basis for an even more radical position taken up by Hume, who questioned the plausibility of assuming that thought could be given such a privileged position, that perception and thought in general were all potentially illusory, that every aspect of existence was potentially a product of our imagination. So where are we? It's worth mentioning Kant as well, as he attempted to solve the dilemma that Descartes presented to science by acknowledging the impossibility of ever knowing what is independent of consciousness, when the only way to know this is through consciousness. According to Philetus, he said, Kant sums up his distinct idealism by the metaphor of mind imposing order on nature. So Kant thinks we must explain our knowledge of things by assuming that at least part of this knowledge is not something we derive from things, but rather something we ourselves supply and impose on them in order to be able to experience. The Kantian argument quoted above recognises the place of the subjective in defining knowledge, and as a consequence, scientific methods appear to be challenged to acknowledge its dependency on the subjective. So it might be said that the very basis for the criticisms that have been directed at Freud's case study method are being challenged by this idealistic argument. The key to the Kantian argument is that is acknowledged by Husserl, and it becomes the basic assumption of a phenomenology, assumption shared with traditional science, that is, that it is madness to question the existence of the external world. It is here, we live in it, and there is no reason to question its existence. However, for Husserl, the question is not whether the external world exists. What is more important is to consider the relationship between perception or consciousness and reality. Husserl suggests establishing a true depiction of the external world is not possible. Acknowledging the arguments of both Descartes and Kant, and the most potentially rewarding endeavour was to rigorously scrutinise individual perception of reality. And Moran states, Husserl believed all knowledge, all science, all rationality is dependent on conscious acts, acts which cannot properly be understood from within natural outlook at all. Consciousness should be viewed naturalistically as part of the world, should not be viewed naturalistically as part of the world at all, since consciousness is precisely the reason why there was a world there for us in the first place. So it gives an elite position to perception and consciousness in this transcendental approach to phenomenology, using the term intentionality to capture the internal understanding of the external experience. Introducing a phenomenological reduction, Husserl believed it was possible to conceive and consequently discover the essence of our perception of the external world, our intentionality, by a vigorous process of reduction. It was from this assumption that the justification of a subjective science emerges, and the various research methods, one of which Julia spoke about, owe their existence to this commitment to the internal resources of a person. Some would argue that Husserl was playing the same old game with different rules. This is positivism with a different spin. One such critique comes from Heidegger. According to Caputo, Heidegger believed that Husserl's transcendental phenomenology had more to do with walking on water rather than providing a basis for establishing a link between perception and experience. Heidegger's conception of Dasein, the idea of the past, the present, the future, directly influencing the way we see the world, directly undermines the supreme transcendental position that Husserl gives intentionality. Heidegger argued that Husserl's commitment to a method of phenomenological reduction was beyond the reasonable expectation of what it is to be a person being in time. We are all subject to thrownness, living in a changing world. As a consequence of what we see is transient, influenced by the moment. It is interpretational. Based on the time and the current culture, interpretation of our history. It was these arguments that I felt most comfortable with as a researcher to position my research. Now, should have been giving you a model of my research method, but I'll talk it through. Don't worry, Lana. It was at that stage with regards to philosophy, the whole Heideggerian argument of hermeneutic phenomenology, that I decided what I was most comfortable in basing my research. And so, working with Dell, we worked with developing an approach to case study method, which was very much taken from, in some senses, operationalising what Freud conceived as his approach to research. The idea that we had was that, in many ways, the looking and re-looking, which is very much part of operationalising phenomenological research and hermeneutic research, about re-examining, reinterpreting, trying to get an idea of what one might be experiencing, we do as therapists anyway. With linking with supervision, linking with personal therapy, thinking about our work, this is a constant hermeneutic process. And we conceptualised that in that way, you know, that there was different stages of that process. And overall, we probably in some senses arguing that we concur with Freud, that psychotherapy could be argued, and psychoanalysis, as a research method in itself. And that's the gist of our argument. An approach case study, I decided that my existing... onto the findings. Okay, I'm very lucky it's not working. Oh, is it working?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Oh, good. Okay. I'm doing wrong next time. There we go. That's the findings. That's the bit I wanted to show you. That's the findings. This is the most important part of the findings of my research. Me.
You found yourself.
I found. Don't know about that. What I found in the psychotherapy with the person I worked with for 3 years. The question was all about, well, could I work with someone who was diagnosed with dementia? And I suppose the expectation of that question is that in some senses this research would perhaps open up a particular way of working with someone with dementia that would assist other people in applying that approach to a similar person, and that we could, in some senses I could write a paper about and be descriptive about how you might do that. But what I really found was that the real problem working with a person with a dementia was me. I was the problem. But in some senses, my experience of the term, of the diagnosis, made it impossible for me to actually see this person as a person. I always saw her as a person with dementia. And so this was the biggest problem with working with someone with dementia in my experience. It was me. And that was a really important finding for me as a therapist, and particularly. It led me, theoretically, to explore theory post Heideggerian theory, I think. The problem in addressing the question of whether it is possible to practice psychotherapy the person diagnosed was me, the therapist. And as I was caught up with the diagnosis, my intentionality, perception, consciousness was overwhelmed by the possibility of therapy taking place. The problems with foundations is it takes so long to challenge it, leaves little time to look beyond. But briefly, I want to introduce a critique of the hermeneutic position that provided the basis for my research by highlighting its dependence on my intentionality. It was all about me. The research, phenomenology, and then hermeneutics are still all about the dictatorship of intentionality. In this case, mine. Stemming the flux, providing stability in what is an external world that is the flux, full of uncertainty, and perhaps the problem is that the human condition needs to stabilise this reality to avoid the uncertainty of living in the world that can't be defined. Heidegger challenged herself for being unrealistic. Perhaps we should also do the same for this hermeneutic foundation. Levinas argues that the drive towards understanding, the promotion of intentionality, our conception of what we see around us, closes down the possibility of seeing the other person. The other gets lost in the drive for understanding. Levinas introduces the concept of the non-intentional, which are the moments before we understand something, that give us a hint of something other than our understanding. The emotion provoked by the tear in the eye of the other, something I can never say without feeling quite emotional, symbolises the possibility to be moved by the other person. And this emotional response is potentially prior to the need to understand what has caused the pain in this other person. It is this raw potential to witness the other person as separate from your thoughts, is what Levinas described as the non-intentional. Our understanding dictates to the world and shuts down the possibility of seeing something other. In therapy, it shuts down the possibility of seeing the patient as anything other than I expected, in the case of my patient, it shut down the possibility of me seeing a person. I saw a person with dementia. I saw a person. I would argue that my intentionality, so overwhelmed by a past and present, working with people with dementia, closed down the possibility of seeing the uniqueness and otherness of this person. And I would argue that intentionality, and a lot of us have been talking about intentionality today in different ways, is also, and Levinas would argue, obviously an important part of our life. We live our life in an intentional world. But there's a sense that so much of the other can be lost by our reliance on it and our dependency on it, and our projection onto other people, our projection of the way that we see the other. And my projection in this case was, as somebody who's worked for 20 years with dementia, projecting my views onto this person. And the impossibility or the difficulty, and it is impossible in some ways, to see something other than that. But what Levinas is arguing is, although it seems impossible, although at times it's extremely difficult, it's our only chance, he argued, for a fruitful existence and future, to strive to look to look the other, to look beyond intentionality, to try to strive for the tear in the eye, to see the tear in the eye of the other.
Phil Bolland to respond, says two papers.
Okay, thank you very much to Julia and Dennis. I had only a few days notice to be asked to be a respondent at this conference. So I read the relevant papers in the book and put together a few thoughts that I hoped might be relevant. So I'm going to say a little bit about the way that words and theories and research are used in the marketplace, and the question of who seizes control of the discourse, and how what has happened is a kind of eclipsing of the unknown with an aggressive imposition of an illusion of knowing and a kind of slanderous undermining of the phenomenological hermeneutic approach that Dennis was speaking of as still having some value, some legitimate place. It's been undermined as if it were illegitimate, but I think it is important. A seemingly plausible, yet false and highly misleading idea has been propagated within universities, the NHS, and the popular media, and it's that psychological therapies are treatments for specific mental health conditions, analogous to pharmacological treatments for physical conditions. An adequate service will diagnose the correct condition and prescribe the correct psychological treatment by consulting the helpful NICE guidelines. And this idea, of course, strikes any genuine psychotherapist as ludicrous, and yet it is horribly appealing and plausible to many who have responsibility for commissioning, managing, or regulating services for those in mental distress. Much, but not all, of the blame lies with the profession of clinical psychology. I can say this because my core profession is clinical psychology. I wrote about this, the malign influence of clinical psychology on the psychotherapy professions in a paper published earlier this year. It's intriguing to wonder at what point the expedient use of diagnoses came to the fore. Because certainly the behaviourists of the 1970s or 60s had no truck with diagnoses in the medical disease model, viewing emotional and behavioural problems as arising from either classical Pavlovian conditioning or the operant reinforcement schedules inherent in the person's environment. Many such psychologists of the time disputed the idea of personality, seeing instead that a person's behaviour is a function of their learning contingencies in the environment. Change the environmental reinforcements and the personality will change. Now, whatever we might now think of such arguments, they were, I think, honestly held. And the clinical psychologists at that time would view each case, each client, as a mutual experiment. They would explore together what worked, trying at the same time to measure progress. The single case study. It was understood that each patient was a unique individual, a person whose learning experiences and reinforcement schedules were specific to him or her. At some point in the 1980s, as cognitive and cognitive behavioural therapies were becoming established, the embracing of diagnostic categories became common. I suspect it was an import from the United States when their era of managed care developed. In order to gain work, US therapists would be required by the health insurance companies to place their client in a diagnostic category and then carry out an approved form of treatment. And so in addition then to various common categories of anxiety and depression, a wide range of so-called personality disorders were frequently cited in relation to cognitive and cognitive behavioural therapies. This is into the late 1980s and into the 90s and where we are now. Originally, the formulations of personality pathology were all more or less rooted in psychoanalytic or at least psychodynamic perspectives. Of course, in the 1970s, the concept of borderline personality disorder was popularized by the analyst Otto Kernberg, along with narcissistic personality and related contributions of Heinz Kohut. Some years later, these and other psychoanalytically rooted personality concepts began to appear in texts relating to cognitive therapy. And now, currently, we find eager young IACT therapists busy putting their clients into the relevant personality box in order that they can determine which treatment protocol to apply. Diagnostic labels can be harmful in a variety of ways. They can have devastating consequences when misused in legal contexts, for example, in relation to custody of children and so forth. And I know of horrible things that have happened as a result of courts being misled by assumptions about psychiatric diagnosis. We should bear in mind that placing a person in a psychoanalytically derived diagnostic category is an act of aggression, a form of wild analysis, if not embedded in an ongoing and unfolding process of psychoanalytic inquiry, and it should not be done. And one pattern noticeable in IAP services is an increasing tendency to reject referrals that are in any way complex. The motive presumably being to maximize good results by taking on only simple cases, in much the same way that the large RCTs of psychological therapies exclude people with any comorbidity, thus making the trials unrepresentative of the majority of clients seen in real life. This is all driven by the marketplace. It is expedient to collude with the false idea of discrete mental disorders, treatable by discrete psychological therapies. People make money by marketing branded therapies, by providing research support, just as pharmacological companies do, by selling trainings and by selling supervision. Companies and educational institutions make money in this way. It is not polite to say so, but it is true. There's financial reward, as well as less tangible rewards of status, power, and influence to be gained through colluding with this falsehood. People, of course, tend to think in accord with their source of financial reward. It's an unconscious determinant of thought and belief that's perhaps insufficiently recognized. Now, one of the most consistent findings in decades of psychotherapy research is the so-called equivalence paradox, that whenever genuine therapies are compared, the work that people actually do, their outcomes are indistinguishable. The difference in outcome between therapists is greater than any difference in outcome between therapies. Clearly, such a consistent finding should be of profound importance. But it is also profoundly discomforting to those who wish to assert the superiority of therapy A over therapy B. This is why such findings do not appear in NICE guidelines. Indeed, most research findings reported, for example, within the Society for Psychotherapy Research, an organisation for people who genuinely love research and finding out what is helpful in psychotherapy, these are not found in NICE, which only takes account of outcome studies for particular diagnostic conditions. And it saddens me that psychological and psychoanalytic colleagues who should know better do not challenge this untruthful stance, but instead sometimes collude with it, in some cases, by developing new brands of manualized therapy, subjecting these to research to demonstrate efficacy, and then marketing them, and making money for their institutions. What's the harm in that, one might wonder? Well, the harm is that the whole business of prostituting psychotherapy in this way is based on a lie, and lies are ultimately weakening. There is harm to other practitioners, who are then under pressure to learn this particular brand, pay for training and supervision in order to become accredited in it. Increasingly, in the NHS, ordinary generic skills in psychoanalytic psychotherapy are no longer seen as adequate, and the demand is for people to have trained in some manualized activity that has been demonstrated in a research study to be effective. If all genuine therapies are more or less equally effective, then the particular theory and technique cannot be the crucial elements. Now, the writings of Freud and many other psychoanalysts have a freshness because they express the attempt to make sense of emerging clinical observations in the consulting room. They're not presented as a manual to be applied to each patient. If we read a case study by Winnicott or Bion or Barland, we do not have the impression of a manual. Our experiences of an analyst writer attempting to communicate with the reader and stir his or her own thinking. These writings are alive with the spirit of discovery. Over time, these ideas will tend to become entrenched and fossilized and deadened and made oppressive, resulting in even the contemporary horrifying absurdity of lists of skills and competences for each form of psychotherapy. What, I wonder, would Bion have made of that current trend? In science, a theory is used to organize data and generate testable hypotheses. In psychotherapy, it often seems that theory is used to generate an illusion of knowing and of order. Just recently, I've had two clients who talked to me of their fears of death. In the case of one, this was related to his health worries and his dread of personal and bodily disintegration and annihilation. In the case of the other man, he seems to have engaged in a manic denial of death through a high level of professional achievement and pursuit of dangerous sporting and other demanding activities. Although he did comment that psychotherapy, exploring unknown areas of himself, was the most terrifying thing he'd ever done. Of what value is theory in relation to death? Death is the realm in which no one is the expert. The client may think the analyst knows much about many things. The analyst does not know about death. He or she has not been there and survived to tell the tale, and can offer no solution or comfort. As we grow up, we may discover where babies come from. We can test out our infantile sexual theories. But we do not know where we collectively came from, although there are theories, nor where we are going, although there are theories. We are similarly helpless against the realities of torture and severe child abuse. These most terrifying archetypes and behaviours, of which we're all potentially capable since we're all of the same species. It was when I started working with severely abused people about 25 years ago that my attachment to psychoanalytic theory seemed to lessen, and I began a restless search for better ways of helping people who've been traumatized, and this search continues. I'm just going to finish with a little story about some paint manufacturers that perhaps has some relevance, and my apologies to anyone who heard me say this before. Some time ago, a paint manufacturer decided to test whether their green paint actually succeeded in creating a surface perceived as green. And so they prepared their paint, commissioned a specific paint roller, prepared a manual on how to apply the paint, the direction of strokes, amount of paint on the roller, how many coats to apply and how frequently, trained their research team in the method, specified the kind of wall that was to be used, used two control conditions, one in which a wall was simply left unpainted and another in which the precise same procedure was followed, but instead of paint, the applicators used water. Then a large sample of randomized subjects was asked to rate before and after the intervention whether the walls appeared green. Having established that their painting system, which they called liquid-based coating, trademarked, did succeed in creating an increase in perception of green amongst their respondents, significantly greater than in the other two conditions, the manufacturer sought to persuade the government that the whole area of professional painting is in a mess. Many different manufacturers producing paints using different ingredients with a wide variation in price, applied by diverse practitioners, some well-trained and some minimally so, arguing that a review of the evidence base for painting was long overdue, particularly when the paint is to be applied in public buildings. A new agency, the National Institute for Painting Excellence, acronym NIPE, was set up. On reviewing the data, they found that the only system called liquid-based coating had been demonstrated in properly designed studies to be effective. Accordingly, they stated in their NIPE guidelines that LBC is to be used when walls show a deficit in green. Practitioners must use the protocol that was demonstrated in the study to be effective, with a specially designed roller and the guidelines for how the paint is to be applied. With the combination of NIPE and clever marketing, people soon began to believe that there was something special and unique about the liquid-based coating system. The company began to train people to use its system, then licensed trainers to train others. Gradually, the old craftsman painters went out of business unless they paid to undertake the special trainings in LBC and became accredited by the British Association of Base Coating Professionals, acronym BABCP. Of course, different studies and trainings were required for all the different colours. In response to these pressures, the other paint manufacturers felt obliged to create their own trademarked systems and to subject these to the same rigorous testing in well-designed, randomized, double-blind studies. Gradually, Knight began to recognize a range of approved systems, with the advantage to manufacturers that they could advertise their products as Knight approved. In this way, the provision of painting was advanced beyond its more primitive craft stage, with great variation in quality and style, to that of an industrialized and standardized procedure. Of course, there were some painters and decorators of the old school who'd learnt their skills prior to the development of the new scientifically validated systems, often partly in an apprenticeship mode. But these were increasingly regarded as simply behind the times. Thanks very much.
Okay, thank you for those three presentations. And we have, precisely 15 minutes to discuss that, or anything else we want to discuss. Any comments from the floor?
I have a question for Mr. Green. Yeah. How did that change your practice? I mean, you were working with people that was diagnosed with dementia, and you said that you realized, you discovered yourself. But how did that affect your meeting with your clients?
I'm not sure I discovered myself, but there's a slip of the tongue, so to speak, but I'm still working on that. I think that what it did for my practice was, I suppose, made me realise how hard I worked as a therapist to understand the other person. And although recognised in many circles that this is and can be useful, I suppose I discovered that at sometimes it's not so useful, and that that when one tries to understand the other, one can get caught up in what I was describing as intentionality, and that is that one has one's own perception of who the other is, and those perceptions often make it really very difficult for something other than that to emerge. And that's why the reading of Levinas has been so instrumental to me as a person, and as a, I hope as a therapist, in recognising that I need to look beyond that if I'm going to allow another person to be another person in their own right. And that's really, really hard. And I think I often make the joke when I'm teaching that, maybe the therapists, people in the training, when they start the training, are the best therapists, because often I think the more theory we learn, the more experience we learn, we have, the more one ends up finding it more difficult to see the other person as other than our own constructions.
Thank you.
You came up on the screen.
Sorry.
No, please apologize. Because I want to sort of focus on that moment and ask, in your work with the person with dementia, can you comment on the role of your own self-disclosure, on how you were seen by the patient rather than how you were seeing the patient?
There you are.
Well, this could be seen a bit of a cop-out, but in some senses, not very easily, because in a sense, I would be in danger if I answered that from my own understanding of shutting that down. In a sense, it's that kind of speculation and that kind of endeavour, which I think is an important part of therapy, is also a way of closing down the opportunities to see something beyond what my understanding of that. But that aside, I suppose where I was caught up in some senses the a lot of the time spent working with that patient was me working through what I thought was quite transferential between us. So I was engaged like everyone else in thinking about
my transference relationship work with her. She was very much provoking the maternal in me, and I think I was very much provoking the paternal in her. And so there was that dynamic. But in some senses, that's where the thinking about the relationship needed to go beyond that, because in some senses that was still just caught up with cliché. And there was something kind of about her real, what I sensed was her struggle, you know, that wasn't about all the words and transference and everything else. It was something about someone struggling with something which was very, 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 very difficult. And it's very difficult for me to speak of, but that's where I think I should have been spending more time. It was very, very difficult to do so.
I think there were some thoughts behind that question, weren't there? Would you like to share them with us?
I was hoping you wouldn't say that. Well, I am pushing against the taboo that as a therapist one never reveals anything about oneself. Because I think if you're working relationally, there are things about you that are known and things about you that aren't. And sometimes it can be helpful to clarify that. I'm asked for who. Well, certainly for myself, possibly for the other as well.
Sorry to put you on the spot again, but it would be really, really, really helpful if you give us some sort of example of that. Is it possible for you to give us an example of what you mean?
I think I want to hand over to the anthropologist here in a sense. I mean, you know, the researcher's effect on the tribe, the tribe's effect on the researcher. An example. No, I think if I try and counter an example, I'm going to start going into difficult territory.
I will.
I think Dion's take on this was that you can be the reality of the patient, but you cannot know it. So obviously, he cannot give you an example.
I was very interested at what Bill Morden said about nice guidance and IELTS. And I would be interested to hear what Psychoanalytic Society do about it. We took quite rightly about people who are looking for financial or narcissistic gain, other narcissistic gain. They do something about it. They try to manualize psychoanalysis and all sort of it, and get involved with politicians who don't know. They just hear one side. But I haven't, at least in the political sense, economical sense of society, read or heard anything from the psychoanalytical society as a whole, but especially British Psychoanalytical Society, and what sorts of responsibility that society take over for the patient, not necessarily our patient, but generally for people who are in stress. Because the reality of IAF, as you said, is not about mental health or prevention for mental health or therapy. It is more political, more economical, more employability rather than mental health. But I would be interested if you have any idea, or do you know any people have an idea to do something about it in the more beyond these doors that we're sitting for.
I'm not aware of any specific initiatives that I can refer to. I know of groups of people in different forums who do
present a discourse critical of Nice. So there are lots of people who try to speak what they feel to be truth, which is all one can ever try to do, speak the truth as one feels and perceives it.
Just on that last point, we've been involved in reviewing Nice guidelines for psychotherapy, and it has been taken up by the UKCP, and there have been questions on how the law the results in from this, and I think various bodies have now got together. I know the British Psychological Society, UKCP, I'm not sure about others. And there is now, I think, an alliance or a petition going around at this very moment. You're aware of that?
Yes, yes. Right. I'm signature to it, but I want something more. I think, again, that is a market. It shouldn't be a market. It should be about people.
No one's got any question. Just like to remind you about our UPCA conference. There was a question about it. Yeah. So 12th of November, you haven't seen the detail. Any opportunity?
Yeah, it was turning into a Lacunian type of therapy session there for a moment. I thought we're therapists up there don't say anything, and we don't either. Can I ask the first speaker? The approach, I didn't quite catch it. Was it grounded theoretical? If it wasn't grounded theoretical, did you consider that? Did you also consider a discourse analytical perspective? Because my reading of it and what I've used for myself is it stays very close to the data, and it also presents one's own assumptions so that the reader of the research can see what you brought to the show, what you feel you brought to the show, they think you brought to the show, and objectively the data. What did you think of that? Thank you.
I don't really think it matters which methodology you choose in the end, because you'll never get at what you're trying to get at, and because you're always kind of distanced by language in any case. So I don't. Part of me just doesn't think it matters whether you use grounded theory. Although I kind of don't like grounded theory because actually it's always about generating another theory, and I kind of take exception to that, really. I mean, I was interested in phenomenology because of this kind of issue of meaning and the way that we're continually reconstructing meaning. But in the end, the problem is not between methodologies. It's with the problem of methodology itself. In following any method, you're going to distance yourself from the experience more. And I suppose perhaps there was a bit I missed out actually in my talk about how once I'd had something that disrupted the method I was using, once my husband kind of made that comment, it disrupted my kind of the rut I was in of following this method. And it got me thinking in a different way. And although I went on to finish the analysis through the method that I'd chosen, I then was able to kind of critique it and offer a different analysis drawing on reverie. And what that different analysis did was it just gave me the freedom to allow thoughts to come to me about what was going on in the room between myself and the people I'd interviewed. And I just think that has got a lot more to do with the kind of practice that we're all engaged in than any of these methodologies, frankly. So I think my problem is with methodology, with research methodology as a whole.
Okay, just follow up on that. Are you pretty radical in this respect? Or would you think that positivism could be good at times for, depending on the area? Because, I mean, one of the things on the qualitative methods in psychology section of the British Psychological Society, and a pretty radical thing of that says that we should never have any method at all, and quantitative is, you know, the work of the devil, and it's probably Tory, and people hate it, and everybody should love left-wing stuff, and so on. Would it be perhaps more reasonable to presume that it's horses for courses, that depending on what you're studying, you use the appropriate methodology, at the same time look at the philosophical assumptions we're making, and then try and draw deductions from that.
It's useful to know where you're coming from. It's useful to kind of question your own beliefs. And it's really rather useful when someone else disrupts that, whether it's a patient, somebody you're interviewing, or your husband. Clearly, my question is not really to do with quantitative, qualitative. So I'm not saying that quantitative research doesn't have a place. I'm just saying that when we're trying to research kind of a relationship between two people, or trying to look at therapy, which is about two people in a room, then this kind of positivist view, and I would say qualitative research is that too, that is problematic because it always stops you being able to think, because and it's an ethical question actually, it's an ethical issue, that you put the method before the person. So you focus on using your method rather than on seeing what's going on. And of course, I think in line with what Dennis is saying, trying to think about what's going on for yourself. And kind of the reanalysis that I did was able to look at the dialogue that I was having with the participants that I was researching with, and the things that they were telling me, and the things that they were telling me about the problem with the question I was asking. And it was only through kind of this kind of notion of what I called reverie that I was able to begin to recognise that and, in a sense, question myself. Sorry, is that a bit long-winded?
I just said something to that. In a sense, there's so much methodology I was trying to get through, maybe it can kind of a bit jumbled, so apologies for that. But I think you ask a really important question, and I think lots of what we've been talking about are specifically related to psychotherapy research, because, you know, questions about philosophical scepticism and questioning the existence of what we see, are much easier to explore in terms of psychotherapy, because it is so difficult to really conceive what we see. But in certain other disciplines, certain straightforward sciences, for example, I think it's easier to say that you could question what you see, but clearly if everyone else is agreeing with what you're seeing, then in some senses, as science does, the race, it's quite clear that the banal questions, to start questioning it too much, but there's no progress in terms of research. But in other areas where one can't ever be sure what one sees, and there's no unanimity in the way that you perceive something, then some of the questions that we're asking, I think, are really important. That's why it's such an important issue in relation to psychotherapy research.
Well, are there any quick last points? Quickly, please.
Thank you. Briefly, an experience. A friend had early onset dementia, which is now hardly recognisable as the same person. I was spent some time with her and her partner, who, quite understandably, was very concerned to try and get it to make sense in order to slow the process down. It was relatively easy, although not that easy, for me not to do that, to behave more like a psychotherapist and just go along with her. And, you know, I enjoy being with her in her increasingly nebulous world. The point I'm trying to make is I think it's important, as Dennis and others do, to talk about the tyranny of intentionality. And even at times, I think we can all become a little moralistic about us getting over-involved with our patients and wanting to know too much. But I suppose what your talk brought to mind, Dennis in particular, was just how difficult that is. And thinking of my friend's position, of course he wanted to try and hold on to the woman he'd spent most of his life doing. How could he not be intentional towards her? It was incredibly painful for him to watch her disappearing from him. But I guess there is some analogy with what we have to experience and bear as therapists too.
All right, thank you very much. Can I thank the two speakers, the respondent, and you for contributing this discussion? Okay, it's tea time. 15 minutes, is it? No, it's half an hour. Half an hour. Thank you.